Carmen could tell that Wynn was fighting to look serious. "Hey, Maddie." A lovely girl with brown skin poked her head over the dollhouse. "This is Catherine," he said. Catherine headed straight for the dollhouse.
"Hey, can I see that thing?"
"If you don't mess up the living room," Maddie allowed.
Maddie looked to be about 4, enough older than Catherine to be totally seductive. Wynn was sitting close to Carmen on the floor. She could feel the heat from his body. She could smell him. He smelled a little salty, like cashews, and a little sweet, like mango shampoo. She felt woozy.
"I'm surprised to see you here," she said, feeling shy after all her bellowing and swaggering with the plastic animals.
"This is what I do."
"I mean, I know you work here," she started.
"No, this is specifically what I do. 9 to 2 I work in pediatrics, mostly here in the playroom. I play with kids when their parents need to talk to the doctors." She raised her eyebrows.
"Really?"
"Yeah, and if you need work, I'd hire you in a split second. You got the place rockin' with that penguin." She squeezed her eyes shut.
"Stop."
"Only it doesn't pay very well," he said.
"How much?" she asked.
"Nothing."
"That's not so good."
"It pays better than my job after 2. Then I go up to geriatrics to amuse and entertain the old folks. They're always goading me to buy them stuff out of the vending machine. I'm going into debt with that job."
A nurse appeared at the door of the playroom.
"Catherine Rollins?"
Carmen got up.
"Hey, Catherine, it's our turn."
Wynn got up as well.
"Your sister?" he asked.
"No, I'm an only child," Carmen said.
She had no idea why she said that. It was true, yes, but true in such a narrow and ungenerous way, it felt more like a lie.
"She's..."
"My friend Tibby's little sister. She fell out a window a few weeks ago. She's going to be fine, but she has to get checked out a lot to see how she's healing. Tibby was supposed to bring her, but her job added on a shift today, and she's trying to save money for..."
Carmen looked up.
"Why am I telling you all this?"
He shrugged, smiling. "I don't know."
"Come on, Catherine,"
she called. Catherine was having trouble parting with Maddie in the dollhouse.
"You can tell me more, though," he added. "I'll listen to anything you want to tell me."
She heard in his voice, in its particular hopeful tone, that he meant it. She knew he meant it in a real way, and not just a charming or flirtatious way. He was sincerely curious about her. He was utterly observant. She could tell that he did want to know her. And on one level, this made her as happy as anything she could possibly imagine. And on another level, it made her sad, because the girl he wanted to know wasn't her. He wasn't seeing her for who she was. He was seeing her as a kind and selfless person who cared about the people around her. He was coming to all the wrong kinds of conclusions. And worse than that, she was letting him.
Show me a girl with her feet planted firmly on the ground, and I'll show you a girl who can't put her pants on. Anik Marchand.
"Vreeland, for God's sake, quit sunbathing and help me get some of these things in the water."
Bridget opened one eye and sat up on the dock. She started laughing. Eric was trying to pull 4 kayaks into the lake at once, and he wasn't looking so graceful.
"Dude,"
she bellowed in a perfect imitation of her cabinmate Katie's low, sloppy drawl.
"You're late. I can't keep covering for you like this."
Bridget lay back down, resting on her elbows, letting the traveling pants soak up some sunshine. She'd already set up all the rafts, oars, life preservers, water shoes, and both double kayaks. She was always early, he was always late. He was always pretending to be put out by the small amount of work she left for him to do.
"I see it's the usual horde of campers," he said. It was another joke between them. 3 weeks into camp and almost no one came for their activities. Rafting just wasn't as sexy as extreme mountain biking, it would appear. Well, there was a small group of boys who appeared now and then, but according to Eric, they weren't there for the boats. If it hadn't been a no-flirt zone, Bridget would have batted her eyes and said, "Well, why are they here, do you think?" But she didn't.
"Why are you scaring the campers away?" Bridget asked. The sun made her yawn.
because I don't want to work, I want to sit on my ass. Bridget smiled at that. She knew how he killed himself on the soccer field, but sitting around was mostly what they did from 2:30 to 5. It was shaping up to be a beautiful rhythm. Drive yourself and your team relentlessly in the morning and laze about in the sunshine with the guy you loved all afternoon. She got to her feet. She'd scrupulously worn her least sexy Speedo one-piece for the last few days, but it was dirty. Besides, today was not just any day. It was a traveling pants day. She had brought them back with her from her weekend at home, and their presence now lent a particular sweetness to the air, even stronger than the wafting smell of honeysuckle. Today she wore them over her best green bikini. Anyway, Eric probably didn't even notice or care. Did he? Why did she bother to think about it? When she got too hot, she carefully peeled off the pants, folded them, and put them on the dock. She shook her hair out of its braid. For her pleasure alone, she did a high, arcing dive off the dock and into the lake. She plunged down deep, not stopping herself until she touched the pebbly bottom. She took her time getting back up. She had always had good lung capacity. When she surfaced, Eric was watching for her.
"What, are you like a whale?"
She pretended to be offended as she bobbed there.
"Thanks a lot. Eric, girls don't mostly like to be called whales. Ask your girlfriend if you're unsure. Human beings aren't supposed to stay under that long."
"Speak for yourself." She swam over to the row of plastic kayaks. "Hey, you want to try one of these things?"
This was a novel idea. "Sure, we might as well look like we know what we're doing."
She pulled a double one loose from the rocky shoreline and into the shallow water. She sat herself down in the front and put her oars into place. He followed her into the water. As he climbed aboard, he made a point of jostling the boat as much as possible, which got her laughing again. He settled in.
"I think you forgot something," she said.
He looked around. He shrugged.
"A paddle?"
"Oh, that." He sat back, tipping his face to the sun.
"Are those really so important?"
He was trying not to smile.
"I'm not sure it counts as kayaking if you just float around," she said.
But she put her paddle inside the boat and lay back herself. They floated for a while. Even in just a week, there had been so much downtime spent together that Bridget was relaxed with him. They talked about things. It was weird to be killing time with someone about whom you felt passionate. She'd plucked up the courage to mention Kaya casually at least once or twice every day. She wanted him to know she understood. She wanted him to know she respected that he had a girlfriend and she wouldn't try to get in the way. He lifted his head.
"B," he said.
"Yeah?"
"B."
She looked up. He sounded sort of urgent.
"What?" "No, B."
He pointed and she suddenly felt a buzzing around her ear. She yelped and swatted it away and it went to her other ear. She hopped up to her feet. The kayak teetered violently. The bee went from her to him. It flew into his hair. He jumped up to his feet and caused an even greater disturbance. She screeched, laughing. She rocked the boat, trying to stay on her feet. He shouted and rocked back. She crashed into the water first. She heard his splash soon after. When they came up, they were both laughing even harder. She sputtered and coughed the water out of her nose. "I think we really look like we know what we're doing." Lena approached Anik before class. She was sweaty and sticky from the restaurant, and her feet hurt and her shirt was filthy, but she was pretty pleased with herself nonetheless. "The woman at the financial aid office at RISD said if I get my portfolio to the committee by the 15th of August, I could still qualify for scholarship money." Anik smiled big. "Nicely done. I warned them my dad is going to ask for his deposit money back, and I asked her to keep me enrolled anyway. She said I have to come up with a deposit by the end of this month." "Can you do it?" "I just took on 3 more shifts at my waitressing job. I really hate it, but it pays." Anik clapped her on the back. Wheelchairs built up a person's muscles, Lena decided. "That's what I call fighting," Anik said appreciatively. "Qualifying and getting are different, though," Lena told her. "There is one full scholarship left to give out, and they have over 70 portfolios already under consideration." Anik looked at the ceiling. "Well, you better do something good then."
After class, Anik waited for Lena while she did her mopping.
"Do you have an hour to spare?" she asked.
Lena figured she could call home and make an excuse.
"Sure."
Effie would cover for her if necessary.
"I want to see what you can do with a longer pose. I'll sit for you.
I certainly can't stand for you." Anik seemed to enjoy her own joke. Lena was timid to laugh.
"Are you sure you want to?" she asked.
"I'd be happy to do it. I'll set up over here." She rolled over to the windows. "We've got about an hour left of decent light."
Lena felt a little self-conscious setting up her easel. It was weird staring straight at your teacher, but once Lena got drawing, she became immersed. She drew without pause for 30 straight minutes. Then Anik stretched her neck a little, and Lena worked for 30 more. She'd never done more than a 20-minute pose, and it was exciting. Her self-consciousness returned when it was time for Anik to look at her work. Anik looked at the drawing carefully, wheeling a little back and forth. Lena bit her pinky nail and waited.
"Lena?"
"Yeah?"
It came out a little squeaky. "This is not a bad drawing."
"Thanks."
Lena knew something else was coming. "But you didn't draw my chair."
"What do you mean?"
Lena felt instantly embarrassed. "I mean, you took the drawing down to my shoulders. You would certainly see a good bit of the chair at that angle, but you left it out.
How come?"
Lena felt her cheeks warm.
"I'm not sure,"
she said almost inaudibly. "I'm not trying to give you a hard time," Anik said. "It's just that the chair is a big part of who I am, you know what I mean? I have all kinds of deep and complicated feelings about it, resentments, of course, too, but it is part of me. I don't picture myself without it. I'm surprised you left it out."
Lena felt bad. She'd thought maybe it would seem critical of Anik if she drew the chair. She hadn't been sure what to do about it, so without really thinking, she'd avoided it.
"You could make a really fine drawing, Lena. I can tell this is the right approach for you. Portraits, long poses. I can see how deeply you respond to gestures and facial expressions. You'll excel at it if you work hard." Anik said it like she meant it. "But Lena."
"Yeah?"
"You've got to draw the chair."
Tibby had never liked Loretta until Loretta got fired. The main reason Tibby didn't like her was because Tibby was too old to be in Loretta's jurisdiction, and yet Loretta acted like she was Tibby's babysitter anyway. And then there was the time Loretta put Tibby's best cashmere sweater in the dryer and shrank it so small even Catherine couldn't wear it. Tibby knew it was petty, but she nursed a long grudge. In spite of all that, Tibby was appalled when her parents let Loretta go, appalled and guilty. "It wasn't her fault," Tibby defended Loretta to her parents when she heard the news. "If it was anybody's fault, it was mine for leaving the upstairs window open." But her parents stuck by their decision, and Tibby was left feeling horrible for Loretta. In the too many hours she spent in her cluttered room, windows safely shut, Tibby thought a lot about Loretta and missed her. Tibby had never realized before what an easy spirit Loretta had. She hardly ever took offense at anything. She managed to diffuse even the tensest Rollins family episode with her lightness and good humor. She was the master of deflecting and distracting both Nikki and Catherine from whiny behavior. This was something Tibby now sorely missed as she listened to her mother square off and feud with Nikki day after day, sending him into paroxysms of loud brattiness. Tibby wondered how her mother had learned so little during these years of Loretta's wise example. One night, Tibby stayed up too late and got overly weepy. She wept bitter tears of sorrow for knowing Loretta didn't have a job anymore, for knowing it was her fault that Loretta didn't have a job anymore, and also for never having told Loretta how great she was. The next morning, Tibby found Loretta's address in her mother's book. She clipped her hair in the barrettes Loretta had given her two Christmases ago, pulled on her most cheerful yellow shirt, got into her car, and set off to the far reaches of Prince George's County. She had nothing but a map of the greater Washington, D.C. metropolitan area and a lot of guilt to guide her. It took her 2.5 hours, 1.5 spent getting lost, but the look on Loretta's face when she saw Tibby made it worth it. Even if Tibby spent 24 hours getting lost on the way home.
"Tibby, Mia,
¿Cómo estás? Dios te bendiga. Ay, mira qué hermosa estás. Cuénteme, ¿cómo te va?
Loretta exploded in Spanish. Not only did Loretta not appear to harbor any resentment, she hugged Tibby like a long-lost daughter. Loretta's eyes filled with tears as she planted several kisses on Tibby's face. Tibby was still blinking in surprise when Loretta pulled her into the small house and introduced her to various family members as though they knew all about her. Loretta gestured to the pale woman on the couch in her bathrobe.
She no get up. She have...
Loretta pounded her chest in demonstration.
Infection.
That was Loretta's sister, Tibby realized. It made Tibby feel even worse. Tibby sat at the dining room table with Loretta, who kept patting her hand and asking exactly how Catherine was doing.
She's getting better so fast. She's great. She misses you, though, Tibby added quickly.
Tibby then presented Loretta a picture of beaming Catherine in her hockey helmet, which Loretta promptly kissed. Loretta wanted to know all about Nikki, and she even wanted to be sure that certain leftovers were not spoiling in the fridge. Loretta cried a lot, both out of sadness and joy, and said many things in Spanish which Tibby could not understand. The thing Tibby could understand was that Loretta truly loved Catherine. She loved Nikki. She even loved Tibby for God knew what reason. How could Tibby's parents fire someone who loved their kids this much? It was wrong. Loretta insisted that Tibby stay for dinner, so Tibby accepted. Then Loretta and her niece and another sister buzzed around in the kitchen for the next hour preparing a feast, while Tibby sat on the sofa with the sick sister watching a TV show. Tibby was handed a big glass of orange soda and was banned from helping in the kitchen. Tibby watched the actors motoring away in Spanish and let her mind go. She was moved by Loretta's capacity to love, even when her employment had ended in such a bitter way. Loretta didn't seem concerned that the whole thing was so unfair, that Tibby's parents had lashed out vindictively. Some people spent their lives wallowing in resentments, and other people, like Loretta, let ill fortune wash right over them. When the table was revealed to Tibby with a great flourish, she saw how proud Loretta was. In honor of Tibby, Loretta and her niece and sister had made steak. Tibby tried to keep the look of alarm off her face. She was moved by this gesture. Clearly, this wasn't the kind of household where they ate steak every night. And so Tibby chewed the meat with as much vigor as was possible for a girl who had been a vegetarian since she was 9. Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. Therefore, ye soft pipes, play on. John Keats.
Let's call her Good Carmen,
Carmen said. It was Saturday, and they had spent most of the morning at the farmer's market. Now Lena and Tibby were both lying on the deck in back of Tibby's house, chins on hands, nodding.
This guy who works at the hospital, you see, keeps running into this girl, this Good Carmen.
Carmen sat up in her lounge chair and crossed her legs Indian style. She breathed in the pineapple smell of Lena's sunscreen.
Good Carmen is taking care of Alia. She's being stoic and selfless. She's taking care of Catherine. She's doing it all out of the goodness of her heart. The problem is that this guy thinks Good Carmen is me.
Is he cute? Tibby asked. Carmen narrowed her eyes.
Tibby, have you been listening to anything I'm saying?
All of it. I just need a little context. What's his name? What's he like? How much do you care what he thinks?
Carmen considered. Truthfully, even thinking about him was fun. Talking about him was jubilation.
Is he cute, you ask? I mean, he's no Ryan Hennessy, of course.
No, he's not, Tibby shot back. He's real, for one.
Yes, he is real. He does have that going for him. And yes, he is cute.
She couldn't keep the smile off her face.
He's really cute, Lena said. I can tell. Look at you.
What's his name? Tibby asked.
Wynn?
She realized she said it in the same slightly argumentative tone he did. She was already taking his side.
Wynn?
they both asked.
Yeah, short for Winthrop. What can he do? He didn't name himself.
I like it, Lena stated.
Tibby studied Carmen for a long minute.
Oh my God. Karma Carmina Carmabel, you like this guy, don't you?
Carmen was blushing.
This is amazing. This is new,
Tibby continued. You do like him.
But he doesn't like me, that's the problem. He is a good person. He's pre-med, he volunteers at the hospital all day long. He likes good Carmen.
So why not set him straight? Lena asked.
Because he won't like me anymore.
Why don't you try it?
Because I'm scared to. I don't want to ruin it for him. I'd rather he have his idealized version of me than introduce him to the real thing. I like the way he thinks of me. I mean, good Carmen.
Lena lifted her sunglasses. She was resolute.
Carmen, that's just sad. Be yourself. If he doesn't like you for yourself, then he ain't worth it.
Hallelujah, said Tibby.
Carmen studied them suspiciously. What's with you two? Bridget sat with her clipboard on her lap at the side of the soccer field, chewing on a piece of grass. She didn't even bother to lace up her cleats these days. She went around barefoot. She even played barefoot. It was unorthodox, she knew, but who really cared? Eric was pacing a few yards away. He was watching his team doing dribbling exercises. She didn't get that screaming feeling in her cells quite so much now when she saw him. She was getting used to him.
Bly it forward, she said to no one in particular.
She'd put Lundgren, the Swede, on defense. He was versatile. The European kids always had the best fundamentals. Naughton, her special favorite, she put in the goal. He was completely uncoordinated, but he had a weird, seemingly dumb magnetism for the ball. At the moment, she had her team carrying out an elaborate pattern of sprints. She wanted to get her roster in order before they got back. Suddenly, her clipboard was in shadow. Away, no spying, she ordered without looking up.
Eric stepped back about 1 foot.
You're crazy to put Naughton in the goal.
I'm crazy to put him anywhere. No spying, no peeking, no Peking, no Beijing.
It's friendly advice.
All friendly till we beat you soundly.
Ooh, I'm scared.
She looked up at him finally. He pretended he was going to step on her feet. She put her hand over her eyes, squinting in the sun. She smiled at him, and a nice thought passed through her mind. I think we're really friends. Eric had joined her and Diana for dinner the past 2 nights. At first, Diana seemed alarmed, but she got used to him. You could get used to almost anything. They spent 3 hours sitting at a table in the cafeteria discussing the relative merits of each of their teams like the three big soccer dorks they were. Bridget and Eric hung out now even when they didn't have to. He joined her for her evening runs sometimes. They ate their lunch on the field together, except Mondays when they pretended to chaperone in the dining hall, and talked strategy. They didn't make a big deal of it or anything. She could do this. She could. It wasn't that hard. She loved him, maybe so, but she also loved being with him. She could be happy with just that. She didn't need any more. Finally, finally, at last, the strange air of their encounter was dissipating. Her new relationship with him had almost entirely eclipsed the old one. She felt like she could trust herself with him now. Bridget watched her breathless team streaming back toward her across the field. She stood waiting for them like a proud mama. Naughton was the first one in her face. She frankly suspected he'd cheated a corner or two because he wasn't all that fast. Hey, Naughty, how'd you do?
Good.
He was trying to catch his breath.
You all get water, she ordered the group. Then we'll get to work.
Naughton continued to hang around her, not quite balanced on his bumpy knees while the others got water. He was always asking her stuff. He was her project and he knew it.
You running tonight?
He asked her.
Probably, maybe a short one.
Can I come?
This was new.
I guess. If you have anything left after I finish with you all today.
He looked eager.
I'll keep up. Don't worry.
This made her remember things that had happened 2 years ago. How she would foist herself upon Eric when he tried to lead runs in Mexico. She would bother him and show off and flirt outrageously.
God, had she really done that?
She was still thinking about this as she and Eric walked to the dining hall for lunch a couple of hours later.
He noticed she was quiet, but he didn't bug her. Joe Warshaw intercepted them at the front of the room.
Just the two I need,
he said, pulling them off to the side. He sort of winked at Bridget, as if to say,
See, your partner's not so bad, is he?
Bridget looked down at her toes.
We've planned a rafting trip this weekend, Joe explained. It's an overnight down the Schuylkill. It's an easy stretch, one portage. We've got 8 kids signed up. Esmer was supposed to do it, but he has to take off this weekend, and you two are both on. Do you mind?
Does it matter if we mind? Eric asked. He knew the way of Joe. Joe smiled brightly.
No, actually.
Well then, Eric said.
I'll tell the kitchen guys to get all the tents and stuff packed into the van. I'll make it easy for you. How's that?
Eric and Joe talked logistics while Bridget's mind raced around the place. She was going on an overnight camping trip with Eric. Oh, God. She trusted herself to stick to the friendly banter during meals and even lake duty. She had mastered that subtle art. But sleeping close to him in a sleeping bag under the stars? She wasn't sure she trusted herself to be able to do that.
Hey, girlies. 41 days. Do you know where your bikinis are?
B. It came to her in a dream. It really did. Lena was dreaming about Valia and her mother and Effie and all kinds of incongruent bits and pieces. And in her dream, she went into the dining room, or a place that she knew was the dining room even though it looked kind of different. And instead of her family members sitting in the chairs, there were drawings of them. Big, wide sheets of paper with charcoal drawings propped on the chairs. Lena not only liked these drawings in her dream, but she knew that she had made them. And when she woke up, she knew what her portfolio project was going to be. It wasn't so much that she wanted to draw a series of portraits of her family, it was that she knew it was the right thing to do. She decided to start with her mother, the source of all things. Besides, she knew she could make her mother agree to it. After dinner, she scouted the house for the right place to pose her.
Sit there.
Lena pointed to the living room couch, green velvet, with pillows carefully arranged. She studied her mother. No, she didn't really repose in the living room very often.
Let's try the kitchen,
Lena said, and her mother followed her there. She sat Ari down at the kitchen table. Better. But her mother was never really sitting down.
Stand, okay?
Lena said. She let her mother gravitate to her own spot at the counter. That made sense. Without thinking, her mother put her chin in her hands, her elbows resting on the granite counter, waiting for Lena to pick.
Don't move, Lena said. That's good.
She brought a stool opposite her mother and propped her drawing board on her lap. Lena made herself look for a long time before she started. She wanted to see all that was real and also what was there. She didn't want to let herself shy away. She started. She liked the softness of her mother's skin contrasting with the gleaming granite countertop, the way the skin of her elbows puddled a bit upon it. Her mother eschewed softness, longed for hardness, but softness was what she had. Lena wanted to capture her mother's worn, slightly bagging knuckles with the hard permanence of her wedding ring pressing as it now did into her mother's cheek. She considered her mother's severely glinting diamond studs, a 20th anniversary gift from Lena's father, sitting in her soft, tired earlobes. Drawing wasn't a passive exercise, Anik liked to say. You had to find the information. You had to go in after it. Lena pushed herself to look deeper into the tentative set of her mother's eyes. The lines burrowing toward her lips made more pronounced by the careful, deliberate way she held them. Ari wanted to support Lena in some way. She would sit for this drawing until every one of her limbs went to sleep. But she needed to stay allied with her husband, too. She'd made too many compromises already this year to pull out. She was an appeaser, maybe, but by now she was accountable herself. Lena saw these conflicts fighting in each quadrant of her mother's face. She saw the tiny fault lines betraying the feelings that pulled her mother apart. Ari was so placid in some ways, her smooth hair, her plucked brows, her elegant clothes in every soft shade of beige. And in other ways, Lena could see she was waging an internal war.
Lena imagined herself a field marshal, overseeing the hostilities between her mother's eyebrows. Then she imagined herself a cartographer, mapping out each curve and concavity between Ari's cheekbone and her jaw. She imagined herself a blind person, feeling her way around her mother's neck and collarbone with her charcoal. She pictured herself the size of a mite, crawling over the canyon-like hollows of her mother's shoulders. When Lena brought the drawing in to Anik the next day, Anik was plainly excited. She was near speechless.
"Do you think I got the chair?" Lena asked timidly.
Anik hugged her, knocking Lena's legs into her wheels.
"I really do."
Should we have stayed home and thought of here? Elizabeth Bishop.
Hey, Naughty. Bridget hadn't told Naughton exactly the time of her run that evening, but he was there nonetheless. She wondered how long he'd been waiting by the road at the foot of the hill. Eric, this evening, had not come. They ran in silence for quite some time. The air was so heavy you could practically feel the water squishing around in it. Bridget had to hand it to Naughty. The uphill stretch was fairly brutal. She liked to start a run tough, and he kept right with her even when he looked like he was going to die. He was 14. He seemed infinitely younger than she, but she realized with some mortification that he was no more distant from her age than she was from Eric's. He kept turning his head to look at her. He was nervous. She paused briefly at the top of the mountain to enjoy the view. It was part of her ritual. The silence was punctuated by Naughton, who was breathing so hard she was afraid he might blow out a lung. She waited until they were headed downhill to get conversational.
"How's it going?" she asked him.
Good.
He worked hard for the word. He waited until they had finished the 4-mile loop and begun walking to unburden his heart.
Bridget?
Yeah.
Do you like Bridget or B?
Either. Both.
Okay, B?
Yeah.
I wanted to tell you something.
Okay.
Silence. Never mind. Sweat made his whole face shine.
Okay.
He couldn't bear to leave it at that. I think you're pretty amazing.
I like you too, Naughty.
He cleared his throat. I think I'm talking about a different kind of like.
Like a girlfriend?
She cut to the chase. This could take all night.
He was surprised.
Yes.
I'm your coach, Naughty. You know I can't be your girlfriend.
That hadn't been good enough for her back in Baja, had it? Why did she think it was good enough for him?
Do you have a boyfriend? He asked.
This would have been an easy out, but she didn't feel like lying.
No, not really.
Maybe after camp? He proposed. I could wait. He was so much sweeter and more rational than she had been. Why seal off all hope?
Maybe someday. Who knows what will happen?
A few hours later, she was sitting next to Eric on the dock. The sun was setting behind the trees, and she was feeling thoughtful.
"Can I apologize to you for something?" she asked him, kicking her bare feet back and forth in the warm air.
"What do you have to apologize for?" he asked lazily.
His hair was messed up by drying with the lake water in it. His face was stubbly and relaxed in a way it had never been with her that first summer.
2 summers ago?
He winced a little, but he let her go on.
"That kid, Jack Naughton, wants to be my boyfriend. He's sweet, but it made me think of myself. It made me remember how I behaved to you, and I felt so ashamed."
She cracked a piece of wood off the dock and threw it into the water. She let out a breath.
"I'm sorry I did that. You must have thought I was so ridiculous."
Eric's face was pained. He was silent for a long time. She brought her feet up onto the dock and hugged her knees to her chest. She pressed her chin against one brown knee, afraid to look at him. She could feel the weight of her loose hair drying against her back. They hadn't talked about this before. In all their many hours spent together, they hadn't mentioned the fact that they'd known each other, much less known each other. They never talked about us. There wasn't any us. But now she was raising the specter of us, wasn't she? Not to reawaken it, she promised herself,
That was not it. Her mind supplied a funny version of the famous Julius Caesar line, "I come not to praise us, but to bury us." Eric rubbed a hand through his hair.
"I didn't think you were ridiculous," he said at last, a little defensively. "It was more complicated than that."
"But it was all my fault, I know it was." He looked terribly tired. One side of his mouth was flat and the other pointed down. She could tell he didn't want to talk about this anymore.
"I won't bring it up again," she said softly, her eyes pricked with tears that she did not want him to see.
"I promise, we can forget it ever happened."
When he finally talked, his voice was so quiet she could barely hear him.
"Do you think I could forget it?"
He brushed his hand over his eye.
"Do you really think it was all you, that I didn't want it to?"
Brian was over, so Tibby stayed in her room. Brian came to see Catherine almost every day. He was transforming her arm cast into a masterpiece, drawing a fierce and sprawling dragon with her magic markers, adding a little more each time he came. Brian also came to see Tibby suspected, but she did not want to see him. He would catch her every so often skulking to the kitchen to forage for supplies and ask her, by his hollow-eyed looks, why she was avoiding him. And she just kept avoiding him because she didn't have an answer. Tibby was perched on her bed, having left the door open a few inches so she could hear Brian's voice but not be seen. That was when Carmen arrived. Brian was careful enough to leave her alone, but with Carmen there was no such luck. Carmen walked in and closed the door behind her.
"What are you doing?"
"What do you mean?"
"Why won't you see Brian? The poor guy is dying."
"He's here to see Catherine," Tibby said defensively. Carmen was not a particularly patient person.
"Shut up. He loves Catherine, I know, but he wants to see you."
"Why can't I just be by myself if I want?" Tibby asked churlishly. Carmen sighed. She was in one of her tough love moods.
"Because Brian loves you, and I am pretty sure you feel the same way. So what are you doing? Like it or not, you're going to NYU in a month and a half. You can't just leave it like this."
Tibby was tired of hearing it. Her mom had been in her room singing the very same tune not 24 hours ago.
"Why is everybody in such a hurry to shove me and Brian together? Why does he have to be my boyfriend? Are you not a real person if you don't have a boyfriend? Why does everybody have to be in love with somebody?"
"You don't have to be in love with somebody," Carmen replied. "But it so happens that you are. And besides, Brian means more to you than just being your boyfriend."
Carmen looked around distastefully at the mess.
"Is this about Catherine?" she asked. "Because Catherine's getting better fast, and you're the one acting broken."
"It's not about Catherine," Tibby said, just to get Carmen off her back. "It's not about anything. And anyway, maybe you're wrong. Maybe I just don't like Brian in that way."
Carmen sized her up.
"Are you honestly telling me that you don't like Brian in that way?"
Tibby couldn't say no without lying, so she decided to say nothing instead.
"Hi, Dad, it's me."
"Hey, Bun, how good to hear your voice. What's up?"
Carmen and Al talked pretty regularly on Sunday evenings, so a call on a Thursday night did tend to prompt the old "what's up." Carmen had been, in her slightly sick way, excited to tell her mother she would not fulfill her lifelong dream of going to Williams College. It turned out she was not at all excited to tell her father. She'd put this call off 100 times.
How's Lydia?"
"She's great." Her dad obviously knew she was stalling.
"How's Krista?"
"I think she's fine." Al was always more circumspect on this subject. He didn't want to make it seem like Krista was the girl who lived with him, while Carmen was the girl he talked to on Sundays, in spite of the fact that this was true.
"Tell her I say hey, okay?"
"Of course, she'll be happy. Now, tell me, is everything good with you? How's your job?"
"It's fine. Listen, I'm calling because, well, because,"
she had to make herself say it,
"because I'm thinking a lot about this fall."
"Okay."
"I might not be ready to leave home just now."
She said it so fast it came out like one long word. "Bun, explain what you mean."
With Mom and David, and Mom expecting the baby and everything, it's hard to picture leaving right now.
Okay.
I might just stay here this fall. I might even go to U of Maryland. I got accepted there, you know, like, just in case.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
It happened recently.
So, you say you might stay home this fall?
I think I probably will.
She let out a breath she'd been holding for at least a minute. No Williams, then?
Maybe not.
Maybe not?
Probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah. The thing is, I have to call them at Williams and tell them. I can't just hold this spot if I'm not going to use it, you know?
Yes, I'm sure you're right about that.
Her dad didn't sound mad, really. He sounded calm. So, I'll go ahead and call him, I guess.
She could hear her father switching the phone to his other ear. Bun, why don't you let me take care of it, okay? I put down a big deposit already, and I might need to work with them a bit to get it back.
Oh no, do you think?
Carmen couldn't stand the thought of her dad getting stiffed for thousands of dollars along with everything else. I think it will be fine, he said. You let me handle it, okay? He was so calm. Was it possible her mother had gotten to him first? Carmen detected the faint smell of a parental plot. Even divorced parents were capable of such things when they got concerned.
Thanks, Dad.
Once again, tears jumped into the breach.
Are you sure you're not disappointed?
Her voice disobeyed her and cracked on the last syllable. He sighed. If you want to go to Williams, I want you to go to Williams. If you want to go to Maryland, I want you to go to Maryland. I want you to be happy, Bun.
How did she get such nice parents?
How did such nice parents turn out such a disaster of a daughter? He wasn't done being nice. I love you, Carmen. I trust you to make the right decisions. Carmen felt that an anvil had mysteriously replaced her lower intestines. Sometimes trust felt like the worst gift in the world.
It's the same old story. Boy finds girl, boy loses girl. Girl finds boy forgets girl. Boy remembers girl. Girl dies in a tragic blimp accident over the Orange Bowl on New Year's Day. The Naked Gun.
The rafting went smoothly. This time there were no dive-bombing bees, no splashing or tipping or crashing overboard. Bridget and Eric made a convincing show of knowing what they were doing. Meanwhile, the campers, 8 boys, did plenty of splashing and colliding and smacking each other with their oars. They had a blast while Bridget and Eric were all business. During the long hours of floating along the hot, quiet river, Bridget had lots of time to regret her last conversation with Eric. It had changed the mood between them. Of course it had. The ease had vanished. They were suddenly considerate and polite. She really hated that. Tension of all sorts had risen. She felt self-conscious pulling her t-shirt up over her bikini when she got hot, even though everyone else was in bathing suits already. She averted her eyes from Eric's bare chest, even though she'd seen him like that plenty of times before. While she braided her hair, she looked over to see him looking, and they both instantly cast their eyes down. When the rain began soon after their dinner of bland camping-style beans and rice, they both looked slightly stricken. There were 3 tents, 2 four-person tents for the campers, 1 two-person tent for the leaders. The two-person tent looked comically small to Bridget as she began to set it up. She could guess that Eric had bargained on getting to sleep under the sky. So had she. That way, he could be on one side of the campsite and she on the other, and they could avoid this whole conundrum. The wind blew harder and pushed fat drops of rain down on them as if to make its point. They would all be sleeping in tents tonight. Bridget was usually good at stomping out tension. It was a special talent of hers. She would march around, boldly crushing it underfoot, not paying it any mind. But this time, it was tricky. It wound its stalks around her ankles and held her fast. She didn't know where to go to change out of her bathing suit. She didn't want him to see her brushing her teeth or her hair. Obviously, she didn't want him to spot her peeing in the woods. She didn't want to walk into him wearing just his boxers, or worse.
She felt nervous about the thought of him watching her climb into her sleeping bag in her nightshirt. When she thought of her recklessness with him 2 summers before, she recoiled. How could she have done that? She didn't even know him then.
Maybe that was exactly how she had done that.
Eric gave her a good long time by herself in the tent before he politely asked if he could come in. He was so polite he was soaked. Lying in her sleeping bag, her hair bundled under her neck, she turned her back to him like she wasn't noticing him getting into his own sleeping bag not 2 feet away. She wished they could laugh about this, but she couldn't find a way. There they were, lying in a tiny orange tent side by side. The rain beat down. She could smell his shampoo and his wet skin. It was awkward in a magical way. She was too embarrassed to consider the tantalizing possibilities that lay before them if she were to let her mind go free. Really, what she most wanted to do was to reassure him. She didn't pose a threat. She didn't. She wanted to prove it to him. She turned so she was lying on her back, looking up. He did the same. She cleared her throat. "Tell me about Kaya," Bridget said. "What's she like?" Eric didn't answer right away. "I bet she's beautiful." He let out a long breath. "Yeah, she is." He sounded a little guarded. He was private about these kinds of things. "Light hair or dark?"
"Dark. She's actually half Mexican, too."
"That's cool." Bridget absurdly wished she could find some way of being half Mexican. "Does she go to Colombia?"
"She just graduated."
To Bridget, it sounded so old and sophisticated and totally winning to be half Mexican and have just graduated from Colombia. She felt herself developing an inferiority complex as she lay there stupidly in her sleeping bag, shrinking into her underage non-Mexican skin. She didn't even want to say anything else, for fear of measuring up even stupider and more juvenile next to his dazzling girlfriend. Why had Bridget invited Eric's girlfriend into their little orange tent? He turned on his side, facing her, and propped his head on his hand. Talking a little, even about this, had made things easier between them.
"Hey, I want to hear about your friends."
This was bait she could not resist. And so she spent her nervousness on chirping and blabbing and yammering away, just as stupid and juvenile as could be. Lena's next hurdle was a big one. It was Valia. Lena had been avoiding her grandmother so scrupulously for so many months, it was almost terrifying to look right at her. Lena half hoped Valia would refuse to pose, but she didn't. She sat behind the desk in the den and looked at Lena straight on.
"You can work at the computer if you want. I could draw you that way," Lena offered.
Valia shrugged.
"I am done with the computer today."
Lena calculated it was already late in Greece. That was probably the reason.
"You could watch TV, if that would be more comfortable."
"No, I will just sit here," Valia said.
Lena had to stiffen her spine. She was looking for a way out, and Valia was looking right at her. Lena made herself be brave. It was rough at first. Lena had been avoiding Valia's obvious pain and her own associated troubles. Seeing Valia's face, she couldn't ignore that pain. Drawing Valia meant not only seeing it, but going in after it. Lena felt that her only hope was to try in stages. How much her grandma had aged in the past year. Valia's skin was so wrinkled, it looked like it might fall off her bones. Her once dark eyes were watery and faded, with a bluish tinge around the irises. They looked out from the folds of skin as if from inside 2 grottos. Bapi had loved Valia. Lena imagined that even when they were old, Bapi had seen Valia as the young, beautiful woman she had been. Now there was no one to see her that way, and as a consequence, she had shriveled up. Lena suddenly grasped her challenge. She was going to try to see that Valia, Bapi's Valia, in this face if she could. She wouldn't just find the sorrow, plentiful though it was. She would be like an archaeologist. She would unearth the former Valia. She would rediscover her in the midst of all the ravages. Now Lena was really looking, and Valia stood up to it.
She looked right back. Lena had never done a drawing with her subject gazing directly into her eyes. It was like a staring contest fought to a stalemate. Lena the archaeologist saw clues in the shape of Valia's eyebrows. She borrowed a little from Effie, who some people thought resembled Valia. She saw her father in Valia's mouth and chin. Lena was drawing what she saw, but she was allowing the past to inform the way she interpreted it, if that was possible. She could see the beauty if she really tried. Valia's usual aggressive frown was slowly sifting out of her features. The parts and places that made up her face took on new, more natural shapes. Lena realized that Valia liked being looked at, and that made Lena consider, sadly, how little anybody had looked at her. They were all afraid of her. They kept their eyes averted from her, who needed another tragedy in their day. They politely ignored or submitted to her complaints just to make them go away. They all basically wished she would go away, or at least they wished her anger, her suffering, her loneliness, her discontent, and all of her complaining would go away. The rest they would be okay with. It was no wonder Valia was angry. Her son had brought her here by near force and now spent the entire time wishing she weren't here. And Valia really wanted to go away, that was the thing. They wanted her gone, she wanted herself gone. What a mess. Lena drew and drew. Valia was an exceptional model. Far better than the professionals at school who got paid $15 an hour. For 70 minutes, Valia stood stock still without a single sigh or moan or wriggle. After a while, Lena felt tears in her eyes, but she didn't stop for them. How lonely Valia was, how much she loved being seen, finally. What a tragedy for all of them that they had starved her so. When Lena finished, she got up and kissed Valia on the head. They hadn't touched each other in months. Valia seemed shaken by it. Shyly, Lena offered Valia the picture.
"I've seen you. I think I finally have," Lena said silently.
Valia looked at it for a long time. She didn't say anything. She nodded brusquely, but Lena believed that on this strange Saturday afternoon, they had seen each other. The next morning at breakfast, Valia was back to her usual tricks.
"Who made this coffee?"
she demanded, acting as though she might very well spit it on the table.
"I did," Lena shot back. "Don't you like it?"
"It's the worst," Valia said heartily.
Lena clapped her eyes on Valia's and wouldn't let them go.
"So don't drink it then."
Her entire family stared at her in astonishment, and Lena felt quite pleased with herself.
"Hi, Carmen. I hope this is the right Carmen. If this is the right Carmen, then this is Wynne. If not, it's still Wynne, and sorry to bother you. Even if this is the right Carmen, I might be bothering you, and I'm sorry if I am. I found your number on the... Well, never mind. I'm not like a stalker or anything, I swear to God. I've never called somebody up out of the blue like this, but I have to admit, I've been thinking about you and..." Beep!
Somewhere in the middle of the night, Bridget felt a tiny tickle of hair against her arm. She opened her eyes without moving a single other muscle. In sleep, Eric had rolled toward her. His head had come so close as to graze her shoulder. She felt breathless. Their bodies were curled in the same direction, hers distantly cupping his. The bottoms of their sleeping bags almost touched. What little sleep she had had that night was light and full of surface dreams. She couldn't go under any deeper, being this close to him. She wondered if he noticed at all how close their bodies were, how their breath mixed, or was his sleep innocent and sound? Gingerly, glacially, she moved her foot. She held her breath until, through her sleeping bag, she could feel ever so lightly with her big toe the shape of his heel. She prayed he wouldn't notice or stir. He didn't. He slept. She withdrew her foot, feeling sorry. She would have given anything for him to want her again, but she would have given even more for him to trust her.
"Don't ask me any questions right now. I'm grumpy, and I'll probably make fun of you."
Effie Caligaris.
Tibby was standing at the front of the theater, waiting for the 1 o'clock show to end. She'd stopped watching the movies altogether. These days, she preferred to stand by the front windows and look out. One afternoon, the box office lady was sick and Tibby got to take over in the tiny room. That was fun, safe, contained, predictable. Tibby wondered once again about the wisdom of her career choice. She wondered if maybe NYU had any openings in accounting, or maybe they offered a program for future toll booth attendants or cashiers. She pictured herself enjoying a career in one of those liquor stores in bad neighborhoods where you sat behind a thick sheet of bulletproof plexiglass and people paid for their stuff through a slot in the window. That sounded about right. She spotted a little group across the street, and she experienced that split second of objectivity when you see someone you know before you realize you know them. The tall one, of course, was Brian. Tibby constantly had to relearn what he looked like now. When he had been the lowliest of dorks, his unkempt hair, longish, unbrushed, needing a cut, had played a role in the vicious circle that had been Brian's appearance. Now it looked conspicuously cool, neglected in exactly the right manner. She bought his clothes for him at Old Navy a couple times a year, so there were no pitfalls there. He had learned to like taking showers of his own accord. That helped, too. The little figure with the giant, lolling hockey player head was Catherine, of course. Every time Tibby saw that hockey helmet, she felt her guts constrict. Her facial muscles pulled into a grimace, even when she fought against it. The sight of it made her feel angry, and it made her want to cry. Nikki was holding Catherine's other hand. Even he had become more protective of her. They crossed the street and approached the doors of the theater. Catherine caught sight of Tibby in the plate glass windows. She waved so fervently her helmet slid to the side, the chin strap bending her ear in half. Tibby opened the doors for them.
"We're going to see a movie at your theater," Catherine shouted.
Tibby straightened the helmet. She was always doing that.
"Hey, look,"
Catherine pointed to her head.
"What?" Tibby said.
"Stickers,"
Catherine was exultant.
"Nikki helped me do it."
The hockey helmet was indeed plastered with stickers, every superhero and cartoon character in the history of cheap merchandising.
"Wow, nice," Tibby said.
"Now I might never want to take it off,"
Catherine declared triumphantly. Tibby felt her breath catch. There was some torture in this she couldn't even identify. God bless Catherine. How could she be how she was? How could Tibby be so different? Why was she so pained when Catherine really was okay? Tibby wasn't the one who fell out the window. Her concern for Catherine had become a waste. Catherine didn't need it. Who was it really for? Forgetting about what had happened for a moment, Tibby looked instinctively at Brian. And Brian touched her tenderly on the hand, enveloping her in a look of support that didn't have anything to do with whether he wanted to kiss her or not. Carmen had saved Wynn's telephone message and replayed it 14 times in 1 hour. So why was she in the hospital, the very place where he worked, hunkered over a book in a corner wearing sunglasses and a hat? It was Wednesday afternoon, and Valia had her usual physical therapy session. Carmen knew where to find Wynn. Wynn might even be looking for her. Instead, she picked the most remote spot she could find, which happened to be a deserted hallway in labor and delivery. It was nice and quiet for a while, but suddenly there was a virtual gaggle of pregnant women waddling toward her. She bent her head and tried to read a few more pages, but she was distracted. So much for her solitude. There was nowhere to run in this place. All the women and their spouses were piling into a room. Carmen was imagining what it could mean, a big wild rave for the pregnant folks, when something began to dawn on her. She looked at her watch. For the most part, she meanly ignored anything her mother said that contained the words labor, birth, pregnancy, or baby. But vaguely in the back of her mind, she knew her mom and David were coming to a childbirth class at this very hospital. Could it be? Could it? Oh, man. She tried to get back into her book, but she couldn't. For pages and pages, Jane Austen's elegant banter went into her eyes and stopped short of her brain. Carmen was curious now.
Once she framed a question, it was so hard for her not to answer it. She put her book in her bag and walked down the hall. She stopped at the room where the pregnant women had gone. It had a frosted glass window, fairly convenient for snooping. She saw the couple sitting on the floor. The men had their legs spread out with their rotund wives between them. It looked pretty peculiar, frankly. The teacher stood behind a table at the front. Carmen had come to the conclusion that her mother wasn't, in fact, part of this strange class when she peered farther into the back and saw the familiar angle of dark hair. Christina was easy to miss because even with her big round belly, she seemed to be shrinking against the wall. Everybody was a couple, and Christina was alone. Why was that? The current exercise involved the men massaging their wives' shoulders, and Christina just sat there. Where was David? Carmen watched in puzzlement until Christina reached up her arms to massage her own shoulders. That was all Carmen needed. The ache in her chest caught her by surprise and propelled her straight through the door and into the room.
"Can I help you?"
the instructor asked her.
"Hold on just a sec," Carmen said.
She went to her mother.
"What's going on? Where's David?"
Christina's eyes were pinkish.
"There was a big emergency on his case. He had to fly to St. Louis," she whispered.
To her immense credit, there was lots of sadness in the way she said it, but no blame.
"What are you doing here, Nana?"
"Valia has physical therapy," Carmen explained. Christina nodded. The instructor appeared in front of them.
"Are you registered for this class?" she asked Carmen.
She didn't say it in a snotty way, but she obviously preferred complete order. Carmen looked from the instructor to her mother and back again. She pointed to her mother.
"I'm her partner."
The instructor looked surprised. Politically, it was her responsibility to be open to all kinds of couples.
"Fine, that's fine. We're starting with some labor massage techniques. Just follow the rest of the class to get started."
Carmen situated her mother between her knees and began massaging her tense shoulders. Carmen had strong hands. She felt like she was good at this. She heard a little hitch in her mother's breathing, and she knew Christina was crying. But she knew Christina was crying because she was happy, and that gave Carmen her own feeling of happiness, unlike anything she'd felt in a long time.
"Hey, you beautiful girls. My dad just sent me a pile of stuff from Brown. My roommate's name is Aisha Lennox. Doesn't that sound cool? I'm gonna live with her. We're gonna know her. How weird is that?" B.